welcome to a new episode of What You Doin' Podcast. You're going to be a podcast where I talk to cool people about the amazing stuff that they're working on. My name is Matt. This time I'm sitting down with Leo Hunt to talk about his TTRPG, Vaults of Varn. Vaults of Varn is an anti-canon OSR-style TTRPG where players take on the roles of adventurers exploring ruins, derelict ships, abandoned buildings on the titular desert planet of Varn. I sat down to talk to Leo because of the release of the collected Vaults of Varn, sort of volume one air quotes, on BackerKit, which by the time we were able to sit down and talk was so super successful. It blew away every goal he said he could imagine for it, which is really exciting. It was partially this interview that made me start thinking about shifting the focus of the podcast from someone has a new thing coming out to maybe someone has a new thing coming out, but also just talking to someone about the cool stuff that they're doing and working on and have worked on. So now as we're approaching the second year of the podcast, we might shift focus just a slight bit. But that's neither here nor there. So let's get to the interview. It's been fun how many people lately, I don't know if it's a new blue sky thing or something, where a lot of people are just like, have me on your podcast. In like very clear terms, you know, people are just like, I'm doing a thing. Talk to me about it. Let me know. It's very direct. It's very good.
Yeah, no, I've been trying to do that more because I guess I'm a little like shy or whatever. I don't really. I kind of feel like I was like, oh, I don't really, you know, I don't want to put myself out there. I don't want to go and guest on people and like. And I was like, well, you know, I may as well just ask. I don't think there's any point being coy about it. So you know, here we are.
I think game designers fall into two camps. They're either very extroverted and are like, here's my game, come look at it, let's talk about it, all of this. Or I made a thing. It's over there. Yeah. Go look at it.
Yeah, I know, absolutely. No, my general instinct is that like I like people to know my work and not me. But I've kind of come to the conclusion that that's like not really how it works if you're an indie creator now and the internet. So
yeah,
this is the turning over a new leaf to try and promote stuff more, basically.
Yeah, it's a weird balance, and we could save this for the podcast, but it's such a weird balance. Like, you have to be how much you have to do as an independent creator for stuff.
Yeah, definitely. No, I think that would be an interesting topic. Sorry, I'm making it sound like I don't want to be here. I absolutely do. It's not like a natural, thing for me to do, I guess. But yeah, thanks for having me. I think it'll be fun.
Yeah, of course. And yeah, no, you're fine. It would be very funny if like during the whole thing you were just taking subtle jabs at like, yeah, I guess I'm doing this, whatever.
I wasn't any. I'm actually too big for this.
Yeah. I don't even know why I'm here.
I agreed to this before I won, so it's like
that would. That would be really, see, that's a good bit. I like that. You just have it in the background, and then anytime I ask you something, you're just like, oh, what? Sorry. Oh, I was looking at my Annie. Like, sorry, I just,
yeah, it keeps falling on me. Like, but I don't actually know who has it. I couldn't get to America, so it's like out there somewhere. Like, I don't know.
It's so weird. Anytime I hear anything about awards like that, if you're not there to physically take it, it feels as though they always enter this ethereal state. Where it's just like, where is it? I don't know.
It's particularly bizarre because like the organizers didn't even contact me. I was like, you know, there's like five people up for it. Like it must at least occur to you that I might be the one who wins and I'm not there. Like, I don't know. It's weird.
I always wonder like how much like security air quotes they have around that, where it's like, we don't want it to leak. We don't want it to get out. We can't email somebody because what if the email gets hacked, or what, you know, how much silly security there is about it.
I think what I meant was more like it even without saying you have one, you could, if you know someone's like lives in another country, you could just be like, hey, if you do win, what's the address for, like, you know what I mean? Like, because nobody did that. There's no like,
if you
there was no like,
if you were to win, what should we do? Should we contact you about shipping? Should we not, because you don't care?
Right, yeah, it could just be a form email. It just seems kind of weird that they didn't do it, but so I have no idea what happened to that thing or whatever.
They're gonna use it next year. They're just like, you know what? We'll just, it's fine. We'll recycle. We don't have to buy another one. That's great.
I don't know. Have you ever read the David Foster Wallace essay about the Adult Video Awards? It's fantastic piece of journalism. It's really funny. He basically went to the porn Oscars like in Vegas at the 90s, but one of the producers, this truly loathsome guy called Max Hardcore, basically was so incensed that he never won that he just breaks in backstage and like steals a bunch of the statuettes and like just kind of, you know, with a screwdriver kind of like it engraves his own name on one of them, which I always thought was funny. So what I'm saying is I'm gonna do that
next year. I'm going to America and they will be mine.
I'm gonna go there. Yeah, they will be mine. I'm gonna dress exactly like Max Hardcore and break into the Annie's.
Max Hardcore sounds like a guy who would wear the suit and tie t-shirt, but then also still wear a blazer over it because he wants to look respectable.
He really is a loathsome person. He went to jail. He's a kind of interesting. No, in the thing, he's described as wearing what must be one of the few long-sleeved Hawaiian shirts in existence, which has always been a description that stuck with me.
I don't know if I've ever seen one of those. That's kind of horrendous. That's
when you start thinking about it, you're like, oh no, I never have seen one of those.
No.
Like, what a completely appropriate and like bizarre thing to be wearing. It's just so wrong.
What a hell of a way to open the podcast. I love this. Hi everybody, welcome to What You Doing Podcast, the interview podcast where I talk to cool people about the amazing stuff they're working on. My name is Matt. Today I'm sitting down with Leo Hunt. Leo, say hello.
Hello everybody. It's me, it's Leo. I'm here.
Leo is joining us on the back of an incredibly successful backer kit campaign for Vaults of Varn 2nd Edition. First of all, congratulations on that. It's not often I'm interviewing somebody while the backer kit is going, so we get to see how incredibly it's going. So congratulations on that.
Thank you.
And we talked about it a little bit in the pre-show. It might get included, it might get cut, who knows. But Leo recently won an Emmy at Gen Con, which is very exciting.
Yeah, I can just keep agreeing with your intro.
That is a thing I did. You're correct. It was very good. It was good.
Well done, Matt. I can see you've done your research.
That's I like the idea of you just undercutting me every time. Just like, you've done a very good job. Yes, good job.
I will stop.
Before we get into it, Leo, why don't you tell us who you are, what you do, and about Vaults of Varn?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Matt. My name's Leo. I'm a writer and illustrator. I've been working in tabletop games for, I guess, 5 years now, semi-professionally, and then it would appear full-time professionally now, which is quite odd, but I think I'm most known for Vaults of Varn, which is a kind of OSR, you know, post OSR, whatever you want to define it as, a science fantasy game, which is set in a giant blue desert at the end of time, littered with the ruins of the far future. And it's kind of concerns, you know, treasure hunters who are various post human misfits who delve into these kind of buried kind of murder mazes looking for treasure and trying to avoid monsters, which is of course a very tried and tested formula, but I like to think I give it a strange little spin of my own, which people seem to like. So that's Vaults of Varn, basically.
I was very surprised when I was reading the Vaults of Varn pamphlets that they came back, they were out in 2021. And it's interesting. It's a thing I try to keep in mind a lot now is the difference between new and new to you, you know. And so I was thinking, going into this interview, I'm like, wow, like I just heard about Vaults of Varn. Like, why did it just suddenly blow up? And then looking back through, it's like, no. It's not that it suddenly blew up. It's that it suddenly blew up into my sphere of observation, you know. And it's always interesting to see when communities and things like intersect, like when something finally pops up that you as a person are aware of it, or a group of people are aware of it. This is the question I got to ask as an OSR person. How were you on G+? Were you in the G+ days?
No, I missed all of that. I found all of this stuff in 2019, like pretty much just as G+ closed. So I missed that era totally.
It's a thing. It's come up like every time I talk to kind of a It's weird to even say old head designer, because it's like, Matt, it was 7 years ago. It's like, yeah, but you weren't there, man. You don't know.
Well, it does appear to have been, from what I can tell, it was a totally different era. You know, there were various personalities who are not around anymore, and, you know, quite a different scene by the sounds of it. So
it was a weird time. And I think it's one of those things where I try not to, like, nostalgia-lize. That's not a word. I try not to, like, green pastures it to be like, oh, it was the past and it was this perfect era. Because I was just talking with somebody about G+, and it was an interesting difference to how other social medias were then, and very different to how they are now. Because even especially now, they've warped and changed so much that, you know, like I said, I try not to paint this, you know, picture as though it was this perfect thing. No, it just did, like, a couple things more interesting that I think let TTRPG's community and TTRPG communities specifically thrive in an interesting way.
Yeah, I never had an account. I never used it, so I don't even really know what it did that was different. But it definitely seems like it shaped an era of the scene, like, enormously. And it's a little irritating, even from an archivist perspective, that you kind of don't seem to be able to access it anymore. It's very odd.
I haven't looked lately. Somebody dumped a bunch of threads and stuff, but that was 5 years ago. So who even knows? Yeah.
Well, I guess this is a call out. If anybody does know how you can read that stuff, or if anything is archived, I would personally love to read some of it. So someone, if anyone's reading, listen to this and they know, that would be great.
Yeah, I'll see if I can find that thing, because I remember there was a lot of work done to preserve, like, the Blades forum specifically, because those were super active at that time. And then I think the Gauntlet stuff, and I'll have to see. I remember somebody did it and put it somewhere, but like I said, that's been years and years.
I'm sure it's around, but I've not found it, so that would be a good...
Enough talking about dead social media. Or, like, do you want to talk about MySpace? Were you...
Just come... I was on MySpace. I don't remember how many friends I had. I don't think it was, like, that many. I do remember curating my top 8 with a certain degree of satisfaction, though. That is one thing that I wish on Blue Sky I could, like, curate my top 8 followers.
And, you know, big public list kind of, like, who your favorite people are.
I think that kind of ruthless social ruthlessness has kind of been sanded out of new social networks a little bit, and I'm just gonna say I actually like these kind of cutthroat meritocracies. And I think it should come back, and I think that Blue Sky should have, you know, my best 8 followers, and I can, you know, I can tell people that I'm moving them up or down, and get a notification when I move them out of it, stuff like that. I think that'd be good.
Just a little bar underneath your profile that's like, here are my Blue Sky besties, and just right down the line.
Here are my besties.
That's funny.
You don't get to choose if you're there or not. I'm gonna put you there.
If you say anything about it, you're out immediately. If you, like, that's gone.
Do not question the order I've put them in. Like, that's not for you to talk about. But, you know, I obviously, if you question it, you're gone.
Right. But
this is not what I thought we'd be talking about.
No, you know, we follow the rivers of the conversation, and then sometimes we take a little 100%. Silly. So Vaults of Varn, like I said, I read through the pamphlets last night, and I've said this before. Sometimes on the podcast, you get going and you just got to take a hard left back to the conversation. You're like, that's a fun, nice goof. And then we just got to burrow right back through.
Yeah, we're turning the car back onto the road now. the thing that I made, yes.
I was reading the pamphlets last night, and first of all, the thing that really grabbed me, and I had to check, like, every issue, the art and layout in this is phenomenal. There's a lot of, I think, like, cleanliness in the layout when information is presented, you know, when there's a particular density. But when there's a piece of artwork, which, again, first of all, the artwork is great, and then the layout and how everything is shaped around that is, as a person who struggles sometimes with reading, like, dense pages, it kept everything very, very breezy, very flowing. In a way that, like, I feel like doesn't happen a lot in these sort of, like, 40 page zine style things. Like there, I feels like there's a propensity a lot of times to be like, here's a block of information. And I look at that and I go, I'm not going to read that. I can't read that.
Yeah, sure.
But yeah, first of all, like I said, compliments on the artwork. It was fantastic. It all managed to be like weird, but in a way that it all fit together, you know, jumping in on that, where did Vaults of Varn kind of start for you?
Oh, great question. I mean, it basically starts with me becoming dissatisfied with D&D 5th edition, which I think is a common thread with people who find the OSR and associated scenes. And that kind of led me to the kind of weirder side of D&D kind of blogging, things like Goblin Punch and False Machine, you know, very obviously blogs that... you know, because I read a lot and I think I have a fairly good, like, taste in writers and stuff. And I was honestly kind of shocked at, like, how good some of the writing in that kind of the OSR, like, blogosphere was. I was like, I've never heard of any of these people. They're not novelists. I don't know who they are. But, like, you know, I was like, well, I actually, like, you know, Patrick Stewart writes really, really well, as we know. Like, and that I was kind of like, oh, there's something really interesting going on here. It kind of seems like the people who kind of write like I want to write and like read the stuff that I'm into are making all this weird like gaming stuff as well. And obviously, you know, when you see another boy, you know, with an ice cream, you want that ice cream. So I was like, I want to make my own kind of world and like express it through this medium of like the game, basically. And so that's what I started doing. And originally Varn was just my campaign, basically. I was like, I want to run an OSR style game, but I'm not interested in I'm not interested in the Keep on the Borderlands and like Greyhawk and stuff like that, but the principles of kind of like emergent gameplay and like lots of procedural generation and that kind of stuff, that was interesting to me. So the vehicle for that for me was kind of science fantasy, because I was also playing Caves of Curd obsessively, and I love Book of the New Sun, so that those were kind of the direction that I took it. I was like, okay, well, I'm gonna do a Dying Earth like science fantasy and, you know, fill it with kind of bizarre like post-human kind of creatures. And COVID kind of happened, and I started playing online pretty regularly with some friends who have really got nothing to do with like RPG scenes at all. They just know me and were like, yeah, sure, we'll play in your game. And that kind of became Varn. And I set up the blog to kind of like document a bit of it, and kind of was like, okay, well, you know, and the blog was doing fine. It was mainly a place for like campaign recaps and stuff, but I just was kind of like, I think I've got something here that I'm pretty happy with, and I thought other people might like to see it. So I made the first zine in about a month, and I put it out there. And I think kind of immediately the response was more than I had expected. I thought I would release that first issue. I thought maybe a couple of people would download it and be like, hey, man, this was cool, you know. And I'd be like, thanks. And then I would go on with my life and do something different.
Mm-hmm.
What happened instead was that proportionally to what it was, or what I saw it as, which was a kind of hacked together little thing that, you know, I was proud of, and I'd learned a bit about layout and stuff while making that first issue. But the response was immediately like quite strong. Like people were writing to me and like had clearly read every single word in it like several times and were asking me questions about stuff, and I was like, well, you guys like really care about this is like... And I've been a writer for a while, so I kind of... you have to get this sense of like, if you're doing it professionally, because like it matters what you spend your time on, I think you need to have this thing of like, I'll cast a wide net and I'll entertain all ideas. You have to be honest with yourself and kind of get the feeling of like, is there a really big fish on this hook that I can feel, or is it not really worth it? And this one, I just was like, I just think there's something here, and people are really, really responding to this little thing in a way that I just felt like, I think this can go somewhere, and I think there's a really big fish out there. And as I'm saying this, I feel smug because I was proven right eventually, and I think the 2E campaign has been that big, big fish that I thought I felt the ripples of, and I wasn't quite sure like how to get it. So if that makes sense. So yeah. There's been a lot has happened between that first zine and this that's probably worth talking about. But back in 2020, I just knew this idea had like resonated with people, basically.
Yeah, and it's interesting, talking about social media or that sort of internet era past, like just even having a blog and talking about your game is a thing that like was really popular for a while and then has just kind of fallen off in that long form way.
No, I know, and it's a shame because I love those old blogs, and like again, another shout out would be Grognardia, the Dwemer mount play reports I can't pronounce his name, so I'm Grognardia, like he was just running OD&D, and he has this mega dungeon called Dwemer Mount, and I think this is back in like 2009 or something, and he just would do recaps of the game after every session and a bit of reflection on like why he designed it that way and like what was going on. And he's a really good writer, and his knowledge of pulp fantasy and science fiction is just astronomical. And I really enjoyed reading like his campaign stuff, even though, I'm not super into the swords and sorcery setting, but like the way that he wrote about it was really compelling. And it's all just for the love of the game as well. There's no financial like incentive really. I agree. Please, everyone, please like write more about your actual campaigns, because like they're really fun to read. Like if you're good at summarizing them, some people aren't, but like. There are some really good writers.
That was the trick, really, was it being condensed enough in a way that was entertaining to read, even if it was a little dry. It was condensed in a way that you got a little bit of just enough of like what was happening mechanically, but you were able to sort of keep the story going.
And get the imagery and like what's going on. And like another one I loved was the Black City. I think the blog's called Dreams in the Lich House, and the Black City is this kind of like basically the pitch is like Vikings discover the alien city at the North Pole from Mountains of Madness, and it's this kind of science fantasy like dark thing. I love those play reports; they're really fun. There's lots of weird imagery and like kind of horror stuff that I really enjoyed. So. Yeah, another one I wanted to call out as being good if people haven't read it.
Yeah, bring back blogs. Just have blogs. Please. It was great. I think people are starting to move like designers are starting to move some of their like design newsletter stuff to Itch, which I think is kind of interesting. I like the idea of there being updates and discussions and stuff around a game closer to where you find it.
Itch is funny because they again, I was talking social media, but they kind of want to like they obviously somebody who works there wants to like have this discussion happening on the game pages, but it's like so weirdly laid out that it's just like I don't know, it doesn't work for me. But please everyone like have your own website or something and write long form stuff on there. I promise that even if you get like a fraction of readers that you would for your tweets or something, people who engage with your longer work are much more likely to like actually meaningfully support you, in my opinion.
Yeah, I agree. And even if all it is, hey, this is the, collection of stuff I tweeted about this week or whatever with some long form thoughts and kind of more nuance and discussion. Yeah. People would like that. People would be into that. I think a lot of meaningful discussion is being sort of squashed by the attempts to fit it into a punchy little post that can, get a bunch of internet points.
Which guess what is actually a terrible way to discuss most things.
It's really hard to have. I think if you want to have a pithy little post, that's fine. but it's not going to be a discussion. And a discussion is a different thing. It starts a different way. It's formed a different way. You have different expectations from the people who are engaging with it. We just need to bring back blogs.
Yeah, for sure. If you don't have a blog, like a space where you can write stuff of whatever length as well, because the other fun thing about blogs is they actually don't have to be essays. You can also just write stuff that's like a paragraph long or a sentence long and post it there as well. You know, there's no lower limit of what you can write there. So
yeah, blog, you know, no rules.
It's all gravy. It's yours. Like there's nobody telling you what to do.
And you don't have to worry about some weird AI coming in and telling you what to do. Probably.
Yeah. Not yet.
Anyway. Yeah, I don't. Asterisk. I don't know. Don't hold me to that.
I'm sure WordPress are all in a meeting right now. I'm kind of trying to work out how they can get generative AI onto their platform.
Between now us saying this and when I finally post the episode, WordPress is going to update their TOS for something and be like, actually, it all goes 100%. Straight into the machine.
Yeah, we've got this deal now where it just goes directly into ChatGPT gaping fucking mouth. Like,
yeah, we pulled a big lever and it just fell right in there.
Mm, yeah, you know, you don't actually even have to post it. It's just like now if you think it in the vicinity of your laptop, like ChatGPT's already got it.
I'm scared now. I'm considering this and I'm scared. I'm scared in my soul.
Well, this is where the whole Neuralink thing's going, right? This is why Elon's torturing all those monkeys.
Oh God, I haven't even thought about Neuralink in a year.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh no. Well,
I mean, nor have the monkeys. They haven't thought about anything. But
that's funny, but oh no.
they're all preparing this like fucking nightmare for us in full view, but. Anyway,
silly games, silly game. We just got to.
as far as I know, WordPress doesn't have AI integration, which is great. So
that's good. I would appreciate that. I want to talk a little bit about the BackerKit campaign because there was some stuff on there that I appreciated. Looking at it as a person who is considering backing it, you presented some information that I think is really helpful and I haven't seen some other campaigns do, and I appreciated the way that you did it. So for people who might not be familiar, Vaults of Varn was originally released as a group of pamphlets or zines specifically, because pamphlets are smaller, a group of zines. And then the BackerKit also mentions blog posts and Patreon stuff. And most of that is getting collected into the second edition, and I really appreciated the sort of specificity and call outs on the BackerKit that's talking about here is the stuff that is not getting included, which is nice to see, to be like, you know, here is all of the stuff, and it's like, here's what's going to be in this, so that if you decide you want other stuff, or if you have all of this stuff or whatever, you know, here's what you can get, here's what you should buy. What was your planning with what you were ultimately going to collect, what you were going to put together for this second edition?
Oh man. Great question. So basically, like, the issue is, of course, that Vaults of Varn's as a project's like strength for me has been that I pursue it through a variety of like different, you know, venues. There's like my blog, there's the Patreon, there's the published, the self-published zines, there's the, you know, the deluxe book, and then there's my own campaign that has slightly different content to any of the published stuff, because, you know, it does. So like, and that's all great, except of course it's not great for anyone else who's trying to reverse engineer all this shit, because it's like, oh well, why did he fucking write about this? Or like, I don't have the Patreon, so I can't see XYZ. Or, you know, even just the free blog post has like 100,000 words of material in it now. So it's like, where do you even begin with that? Mm-hmm. So the question was, the question is like, where do you even begin with this stuff? And the attempt basically with the second edition book is to make a book that collects the first three zines, because that's what everybody wants. So they're all in there, you know, that's all there, everybody. But The real question for me was not about collecting those zines, because they exist already and they're in the deluxe edition, but it's like how to kind of integrate that with all of the other stuff that I've written since like 2021, and like what's the kind of best of, what's the stuff that like fills the holes in those first three zines and like supports them in a way that like I can really slap a big hand, you know, slap the top of this book and be like, this bad boy can fit everything in, basically. But of course, paper is limited, books can only be so long, and I want to, you know, I'd like to ship this as a small parcel, ideally not a large parcel. They're different categories, so they can't be too thick. And all of that means I got to make some choices as well about what doesn't go in there, and that means that stuff ends up getting left out. And yeah, but I think basically what you're saying about the campaign is like, I'm not hiding anything. Like, I'm not trying to put one over on anybody. I'm not trying to say something is what it isn't, because you'll get it and you'll see that it isn't what I said, and then you'll be mad at me. And like, why am I, you know, I'm not trying to like, you know what I mean? I'm not trying to pull a first one. So it's like, yeah, if you have the first three zines, you have probably like 50% of the content in the book. You know, if that bothers, if you don't want to buy it again, that's fine. Like, you don't have to. But I want to be really explicit about what is and isn't included. And even down to like the fourth issue, like a couple of the pages from that are actually in the core second edition book, because there's some rules that are like separate from the big setting concept of the fourth issue. So it's like, you know, they may as well be in the core book, but because they don't depend on the rest of it. But then the setting of the fourth issue needs a lot of like space to like establish itself, and there's not really enough room in the core book. Is this answering the question? I think this is
answering the question. Yeah, no, you got there. So you approached it, it sounds like you approached it really from the perspective of, here is the size and sort of length, you know, and you know, size from like page count and like physical dimensions that you want to make, and then how do you fit the information and everything in there? Like, how much can you actually put in there?
Yeah, that's the whole thing. Yeah, is the it's you know, it can't be the size of a phone book. It has to be X dimension. Therefore, not every word that I've written can be in there. And then, okay, so then it's like, okay, so what do you cut out? And actually, happily, the answer to that has turned out to be pretty easy. So, you know, I've seen some people being annoyed that, like, the fourth issue isn't included in its entirety. And on the one hand, I understand the complaints, because, like, you know, if you see the purpose of the core book to be all of the existing zines in one hardcover, then obviously that will annoy you. That isn't what I see the purpose of it as being. But obviously I understand the other view.
I think sort of the gut expectation would be everything collected in one book, which is probably what those people want, right? Is here's everything Vaults of Varn in this one book, here we go. And it to me, it sounds like from the backer kit and from your explanation that what you want is, here is the rules in a sort of digestible way. That then, if you want more stuff, you know, because it's not like this is the end of Vaults of Varn. It's not like you're like, here you go, we're done and we're moving forward, or, you know, we're moving on to new projects. So it's like, here's the rules. Here you go. Anything that we make going forward, it's gonna reference back to this. Here you go.
Yes, right. This is the foundation. This is like the core book, which you know, I there's a lot of content in there. You won't, frankly, if you want to play Vaults of Varn, you won't need anything else. But like going forward, and there are going to be new more books because it's done really well. Going forward, like there will be new campaign books that sit on top of this one as a baseline. And then if you want to do a different campaign, you have the core rule book and one other book, and that's kind of how it works, basically.
Yeah, I think it's perfectly reasonable. And like I said, with the backer kit, I really appreciated the sort of like you know, the clarity that you said. It's these three zines. It's this little bit to tie together in the rules. It's not this or this. So, and if you don't feel like that's worth it, then, you know, there you go. You know, and I kind of appreciated just the clarity. And I wonder if that that clarity and specificity helped a lot of people decide to back it, to be like, oh, you know what, it would be nice to have the core rules as just a nice little book at the table,
yeah,
rather than all of these little printed zines or whatever they have.
No, definitely. I mean, I think when you're marketing, and I think this is just kind of my take on it, is the people you're marketing to aren't stupid. Like, so, you know, obviously you want to present yourself in a good light, and I'm not going to do myself down, but like, just like tell them what the thing is. Like, you don't need to obscure it. Unless you're selling them literal snake oil, obviously, in which case you do. But you know, if you're trying to pitch people a book or whatever, like, tell them why they should be excited about it, and like, but also, you know, don't misrepresent what it is. You know, like, give people as much information as they need to decide whether it's for them or not, and that will always be the best move, I think.
I was reading, I'm probably gonna say this like five times, I was reading the zines last night, and I was getting ready for bed, and I was brushing my teeth, and I was thinking about how I would run the faction conflicts in Gnomon as like, mm-hmm. I'd finished reading the factions, and I was going to bed, and I was, and it's been a little while since a book has grabbed me like that, that sort of just like immediately got me thinking about how I would run it, what sort of character traits were interesting, how I think people would be interested in seeing these characters play off of each other. And like, I think if nothing else is, for me at least, a fantastic recommendation for Vaults of Varn, like, go check it out. Like, it's a fantastic setting. It's very rich. It's very rich in a very quick way, which is a thing that a lot of people appreciate in the OSR, and I love to see, of just like, it doesn't waste any time. Like, here's what Varn is. Here's the people of Varn. Here's their stuff. You know, the second issue is all the you know, your big city, and you're going through, and you're immediately presented with the conflict and the NPCs. And it has a very light touch with the fiction that I enjoy. As much as I enjoy a lot of more, you know, a lot of more narrative focused games, a lot of less, it's silly to even say less rules light, because, you know, OSR is very rules light when it wants to be. But I feel like sometimes the story gets lost in the focus on not have, you know, the focus on not having rules means that the story sometimes gets lost. Whereas with this zine, it felt like it was like, here's the rules. All right, we don't have to talk about that anymore. What was your kind of intention with designing, like, Varn as an OSR game, specifically?
Oh, okay, that's an interesting one. You mean as in like the rules, or like the setting, or what? Because I guess they kind of,
I mean, I guess the rules, because I think it wouldn't be, you know, in 2021, I don't think anybody would have been surprised if something like Varn was made as a D&D hack. Right. Like, there are probably any number of games and blogs and writers that made stuff around that time that just said, well, we'll take D&D and we'll do this and this, you know. And I, you know, getting to it, I appreciated a lot of stuff in Vaults of Varn. You presented a lot of information, but you didn't present a lot of ways to resolve it mechanically. In a way that, you know, like I said earlier, like, talking about the readability, it kept all of the pages really clear and really readable and really evocative. You know, I wasn't worrying about like, oh, what is the to hit on this anti-material rifle or whatever. I was just like, oh, that sounds like a goofy, you know, that sounds cool. Like, oh, I shoot this gun and then it shoots him again. That's rad.
Oh yeah. I know the one you mean. Yeah. Yeah. I think basically like, the design ethos is like probably following my own brain, which is that I'm not very good at maths, and I get very impatient with having to read like rules that I find are too kind of mathsy, and I'm like almost, I guess I'm almost like a free, I can't pronounce this one either. I really struggle with these like German kind of words.
Oh, the free Kriegspiel?
Kriegspiel? Yeah, the free Kriegspiel thing of like, the most important thing is actually like the fictional world itself, and you know, the I think what I kind of want to do is like break down the barriers between like your imagination and like the game, you know, like that I feel kind of can exist sometimes. And for me, that kind of means like that means unified mechanics, like maths that I can do without having to look it up, and you know, kind of trying to follow the principle of like big number on the D20 being good usually. But I think the way that it's designed is I'm usually looking for a specific like gameplay effect. I don't mean gameplay effect in terms of like, I don't know, like I want people to roll X or Y stat. I mean more like I'd like it to produce this kind of like session or like gameplay experience, if that makes sense. Mm. Which is different, which I will say is different to saying I want to make this kind of story or tell this kind of story. But I want to like create the space for certain kinds of interaction or things to happen, if that makes total sense. Mm-hmm. So the Gnomon factions are a great example of this, though, because they're all... I'm glad that you found them compelling. They're not accidental that they're like that. They're quite carefully designed. They're not just kind of dashed off on a... Be like, okay, I think X, Y, Z. They're all... They all exist to give a certain kind of experience and fit a certain kind of role in a story that might happen. And that even comes down to like, you know, separating out the nobility who technically rule the city, and then the army who actually provide like the muscle, you know what I mean? The hegemony. And like those guys are tight and they work together, but like they're deliberately presented as being different to give you the idea that like, and the two, you know, the noble and the general are quite different personality wise. And the point of that is that like actually they don't work together super easily, and like you might be able to put a wedge between them because they're not very similar people. Or, you know, obviously the Water Baron exists to give them like a foil and to kind of keep everybody, you know, keep all the other factions on edge because everyone has to care what like they're doing. And I hope that makes sense. Mm-hmm.
I'm always interested in the whys when people make a game, you know, like, why did you pick this system? Why did you pick this resolution? Why did you pick, you know, what made this decision go this way? And, you know, that's kind of the whole point of the show. So
I guess one of the thing would be why Knave specifically actually has a very easy answer, is because the original release was so bare bones, and because crucially, it came with an editable Word file of the rules. So I could very easily, I could extremely easily make a quite nice looking rules reference for my Vaults of Varn players, which crucially also contained the differences for my particular game, which I think was a fucking awesome thing that Ben did, and like really, really very clever. You know, so that worked.
It's been really interesting to see the last couple of years as a person who is, I say this all the time, I'm not a TTRPG creative. I'm an enthusiast. I'm a fan. I'm very specifically a person from the outside looking in to this space. It's been interesting to see over the last 6-7 years at this point, the shift in focus for these games to having rules around third party creation, and having that sort of be more on the forefront of the design and the intention and the available information. You know, like you look at something like Mothership, you know, the strength of the third party sort of space in Mothership can't be denied. And that's because they, you know, sort of had very specific language and intention with how all that works. And so it's been very interesting to see that space open up in a way that I feel is positive, right? Because I, you know, that space has always existed. The hacks and games and you know, spinoffs and whatever has always existed. But it's great to see people make a game, you know, something like Mothership or Cairn or anything like that, and say like, hey, here is a way in which you can sell your stuff for my game. Yeah. And all you got to do is say this and we're good, you know? And I guess more specifically the intention of it being light-handed, you know, and sort of light touch and say, you only need to do this and this and we're cool and we're great. And to more so even say like, we'll help you promote it. We'll talk about your stuff. We'll put you on the website. We'll put you on this. We'll put you in an itch collection or something.
Yeah, definitely. No, well, it's smart. Yeah, the way that this kind of, whatever you want to call it, art form game, you know, type of game works. I think that's kind of built into it because there's a... I think what people, well, not that they forget, but what I think what's hard... There's a reason why it's hard to convey what's fun about these kind of games to people who aren't into them, I think, because like you really, in a way, you sort of really have to be there to like, you know, I think that they're performed, you know, and like they're not theater, but they have something in common with like plays where like, you know, a great play can be performed really badly or alternatively really quite average, you know, quite an average script can be elevated by, you know, insanely good performances, right? And actually, there's something similar going on with role-playing games. I'm getting around to the point, I promise. But basically, I just think to really fully interface with the hobby, you kind of have to be taking these texts and making them your own, right? Like you have to perform them and you have to add your own stuff. And in that context, having a kind of license where it's like, you got to step off my lawn and like you can't do XYZ and you can't, you know, all this shit's trademarked and like you if you even write the name Vaughn, you're gonna have to pay me. like what in what world does that make sense? It doesn't make sense morally to me, it doesn't make sense artistically, and I think it sure as shit doesn't make sense commercially either, because like apart from anything else, like the mothership guys or whatever, that they're not just encouraging third-party creators out of the goodness of their heart. They're smart enough to know that, like, every single third-party adventure is another argument for why you should buy Mothership, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, when one of the biggest resources is, like, attention and a fan base, like, the kind of open third-party licenses are a no-brainer. It's why it's why obviously like the Wizards of the Coast stuff just shows that they don't understand their own product, or like the people making the decisions don't, which is not a surprise, but you know.
Yeah, it's one of those like, well, of course they don't know, but also like wow do they not know.
They just don't get it. Like it's not the same as like a movie IP or like a video game or something. And you know, like 5e has a fucking gigantic third party community, like arguably Critical Role as a third party community, you know what I mean? Like they're kept afloat by all this stuff on like the DMs Guild and all the people who want to make stuff for that game, you know? A lot more than the frankly absolute dog shit they put out is like the official adventures from what I've seen. Like
yeah, I haven't heard, even from people who like fifth edition, I haven't heard a good word about a fifth edition product in more than a little bit.
No, that's what I mean. It's probably the most successful role playing game of all time, and its own fucking fans don't like the official adventures. They like Curse of Strahd, and that's about it. Like its success is completely predicated on like the third party community, from what I've seen, and like you know the people who do stuff with that text.
Mm-hmm. Which you know, hey, again. Shout outs to independent creators. It's why, you know, it's why I love doing this show. It's why I love talking to people. It's why, I mean, I spent however long I did on TikTok, and I keep meaning to make more TikToks talking about people's stuff.
Yeah, 100%.
Because there's so many, you could spend, a friend of mine said this the other day, you could spend every day playing a different TTRPG and you'd never run out. There's so many different games out there, and people should play different games. That's we hit on this in a really organic way. It's funny, I bring this up. The intention of the show is not to shit on D&D, but if it happens, it happens. I'm not gonna stop it.
Yeah, I actually try not to, because I get very tired of you know, it was more of a thing on Twitter. I don't see so much of it on Blue Sky, but the kind of subgenre of like indie people who just kind of that it seems to be like their main thing is like either complaining about D&D and Wizards of the Coast, or like complaining about D&D and then talking about how their game fixes these problems. Mm. And like, you actually should be spending money on their game on itch instead. And I want to say that I hate that marketing strategy, and I'm glad that I don't have to see it anymore, basically.
Mm.
It's very annoying.
I used to be like that for more than a little bit. I used to focus a lot of no. I used to focus a lot of energy towards talking about how bad D&D was, and talking about how you shouldn't play D&D, and why all of this, and why all of these problems. And I don't know if I just like hit my head one day, or if someone said something in just the right way to me. But I realized I was like, this is a waste of so much effort. Like, it's just so much wasted effort, in that like all of the, you know, all of the attention and energy that I could be putting out could be talking about people's cool stuff, or, you know, or promoting someone else's cool stuff, or helping people promote that cool stuff. And
what are you doing?
And it feels so much more. It feels so good. Like, it feels to in a very weird way, it feels better, because like, when you make an angry TikTok about D&D, you're making it angry. You're just angry. You're just angry in this TikTok. And it's like, that's bad. 100%. That feels bad.
And also, it feels bad. And also, you know, it's an attention economy. And you're getting mad about 5e or 5.5 or whatever. But you're still talking about them. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, you're still... negative publicity is still publicity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as I think various... various political figures have shown us over the last decade as well. Actually, like, it's
getting too real. It's getting too real again. No, I'm joking. You're fine. No,
you
never.
You heard it here. I'm directly comparing 5th edition to Trump. No, I'm not.
I like you were bought in the last second. You're like, no.
I'm just aware of like. I just don't care about people taking it out of context or whatever, so I'm not going to do it. You can, if you want to clip it and where I almost said it, then everyone have at it.
So getting back to Varn, Varn, you describe Varn as an anti-canon setting,
yes.
And I think I've been thinking a lot about canon over the last couple years, in sort of the fallout of the MCU and Star Wars movies and all of this. And I'm curious what your thoughts are with, I think it's interesting to have a setting that you describe as anti-canon. I don't mean this in a negative way. If it comes across negative, I don't mean to. I think it's interesting where you're like, this is an anti-canon setting. And then in issue two, you're like, here is this canonical city in the setting. And I know those ideas aren't, you know, combative or exclusionary, but I'm curious what your thoughts are in saying that, and then continue to shape the setting and what that means for you, like, in the design space.
I will say first up, I'm actually really glad that you asked this question, and this actually shows that I will drop this little bit of marketing knowledge for you guys for free, because and this is slightly contrary to what I said earlier about people not being, not treating people like idiots. But if in the introduction to your game or in the kind of blurb, you describe it as something, people will very frequently repeat that that is what it is. And they usually won't question whether subsequent stuff you write actually may contradict the stated aim. And I am a great example of this. So yes, you're completely correct. Varn is described as an anti-canon setting a couple of times, particularly in the original first scene, and then it very much does at this point have its own like canon in scare quotes, because I can't stop fucking writing stuff. And As you said, some of the stuff that I write is very much for the avoidance of confusion with people. Varn's quite well known for being the setting that's all random tables. So the kind of gimmick is that a lot of the setting is, although the setting is very, to me, it's actually very close in a lot of ways, it's very closely bounded in what it is and it is not. But the way that that's presented to you is not always through prose. It's presented to you through random dice tables where you like generate your own locations. But I will say the key thing is that it's not completely just whatever. The things on the dice tables are kind of repeatedly returning to the same themes and like imagery, with the result, hopefully, that the things that you build, although they're weird, are kind of coherent and feel like they will fit together in some way. Doesn't always work, but it seems to work for people. On that note, though, so I think for me, basically, anti-canon means, like, don't bug me about if I contradict myself.
No, that's great. That's a great design to have, honestly.
Yeah, just don't email me about this. Don't write to me asking about. I think this is actually a great question because this gets to the heart of like my design philosophy, and I think it is one that annoys people a bit too. But I'd love to just hear me out, guys. So I believe this is shocking. I know. I believe that fantasy settings and worlds are not real places. They're not real, they're not literally real, they're not figuratively real. What they are is, how can I put this? They're first and foremost for me, they're emotive spaces. They're places that I want to evoke emotion, I want to kind of make you feel or like think of something, and that's what's really important to me. To me, they aren't logistical or rational spaces, and I think people struggle with this sometimes because, as an example, there is no map of Vaan, and that's like quite deliberate. You know, there's no kind of fantasy map that tells you XYZ where things are. You will get maps of like specific locations, but there's very deliberately no like, here's the big hex map of Vaan and here's all the stuff that's there, because I don't want to show you that, and I don't want to make one, because to me, the point should be like you can kind of make your own map, and you know, like no, there is the city of Nomon, sure, but like it doesn't really say where it is, and the point is that you can put it where you want. Obviously people will be saying there is a map on your blog, and like yeah, there is one from 2020. It's quite figurative, it's quite abstract, it's not like a super representational one. It shows roughly where the regions are in location to one another, but that's about it. I also wish that I'd never published it. If I could erase one piece of Vaan material from existence, it would be that one, because I don't want to, like, I don't like showing people the map, basically. I think it makes it less interesting. Mm. This is getting kind of... So anyway, me saying that anti-canon is kind of... to do with that as well. To me, what matters to me about Vaan is not trivia, and it's not the minutiae of like where is the new hegemony and like how far away is it and like that kind of stuff. I kind of don't care. And what matters to me is the hegemony is this kind of like slightly distant, dysfunctional empire that will occasionally send soldiers after you if they get too annoyed with you. That's kind of what matters. I don't know. It's not quite anti-canon in a sense of like, obviously Luca kind of invented this concept, and he has the really awesome thing where you can like literally roll on a dice table to like get the origins of certain things and things like that. And I don't quite go that far. But kind of, and I think there's this kind of what I would call like Wikipediaing of like fantasy fandom, and you know, kind of like everything has to be measured and like categorized and kind of memorized, and I don't like interfacing with fictional worlds in that way, and it doesn't interest me.
Mm.
And I kind of stick that in the intro to be like, don't do this, and like don't bug me about like how far away something is, because I don't care. And
I think that's a great sort of design track to take. especially when, you know, when you establish like, hey, it's a big planet full of blue sand. Where is this stuff? Man, I don't know. Over there. That way. Just go that way.
It drives some people crazy. They really don't like it. But, that's just how I am. I don't know.
And it's very refreshing. And not that this is done a lot in the indie space, but I know, like, you know, for 5e and even, you know, Pathfinder that I enjoy, a thing that, you know, and, you know, I mentioned talking about it in reference to like thinking about the MCU films and Star Wars and stuff, and this sort of weird obsession people have with filling a space. I'm a big old Lost fan, and I loved early Lost when it was a lot of big mysterious space, and we had, you know, you knew something happened near the beginning and you knew what it was now, and you were like, well, how did it get that way? And sometimes they told you, and sometimes it was bad, and it was like, you know, sometimes they would explain how something happened, and I was like, ah, I wish you hadn't, because this is unexciting.
No, I can't remember who I'm quoting here. I think it's some like philosopher guy. But the a bowl isn't useful without empty space. You know, it's just a lump of clay. Mm-hmm. Like you have to, or like a bottle. Like you can't. And I firmly believe, as you said, that like fictional worlds work the same way. And the obviously, with any art form, knowing how and where to leave empty spaces is part of the art. And people will have different opinions on how big those spaces should be and like where they're located. But you have to leave some. And, you know, over explicating the entire thing, I think, is just fucking death to like fantasy. Basically, it's it removes what makes it interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
Coming back to another part of your question, though. I think the thing is that, stuff like Gnomon actually. It is canonical in a way because it presents like this city that works in quite a specific way, and as you said, has specific named characters who exist and have specific personalities. I will point out, however, that I did have one concession to this, where each of the faction leaders can be played two ways, so they can be either antagonists or allies, and crucially, that depends on your decision on how you want to play them. And they don't change that much, most of them, but the way that they're framed does. So that's another thing of kind of anti-canon, where to me, those characters are like tools to use to make a game experience rather than canonical fictional characters who have to be a certain way because that's how they are. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a thing that, I don't know if people struggle with it, but I've struggled with it reading some games and running some games. You know, you struggle with the weight of everything in a setting, or you're like, oh gosh, like I have to make sure, like, oh, what gods would be here? I don't know what, you know, and you try to keep all of this information together and make sure it's salient and you know, correct in big air quotes. And I think what's exciting about a lot of games in the OSR space, and I think a lot of it is because of how they're presented. You know, when you're presented a game as a collection of like four or five little books, or oh, here's like the core rules, and then the rest of it is just like you just got to read this guy's blog or something. I wouldn't say that you feel empowered intentionally, but you feel consequently empowered to ignore and rewrite the bits that you don't like. You know, so if you're playing Vaults of Varn and you're like, you know what, I don't want Gnomon in my city at all.
Yep.
Yeah, that's fine. You just throw it to the side.
Right. And that absolutely, that's what I mean by anti-canon. And I am specifically in those books instructing you to do that. Like if that's what you want to do, you know, like mm-hmm. It doesn't bother me. Like just get rid of it if you don't like it.
Almost every page of Vaults of Varn or like every chapter ends with like, or whatever you want, in a very funny way, in a very just like, yeah, so these guys do this, and like, here's the, like, I think it's the Mystic Gifts chapter, you're like, so here's the Mystic Gifts, you know, when you get one, you roll, and then, like, here's how you can spend it and do the effect, or here's a table if you want to just, like, come up with your own, man, I don't know, whatever, don't worry about it, you know, just, it's over there, whatever.
Yeah, I've tried to, you may be amused to learn that I've actually had to been trying to cut those out of the second edition a little bit, because I feel I feel a bit like that rhetorical pose now that you're paying me £40 for a hardback book is slightly a little bit different to when it was a free zine. And I'm just like, I was literally just like, I don't care. Like, you can do this if you want. I have to pretend to care a little.
Use the book or whatever. I don't know. Yeah. You paid £40 for it. Do whatever you want.
Yeah, you're the boss. I have to pretend that I've like, I care a bit more about this stuff now.
I think that it pulls us back a little bit to the previous conversation where we talked about, you know, people writing up their campaigns and stuff. I think it was interested to be presented with the way other people ran their games because it showed you in actuality that like, oh, people ignore stuff all the time. Or people just go like, oh, I don't worry about all this. And I don't worry about how this skill works, whatever. It's just D20. And then, you know, it's this skill, whatever, you know. I think it empowered people in an interesting way.
100%. Yeah, everyone's version is slightly different, and like, and yet they're all kind of the same too, which is the even weirder thing. Is like, even though the kind of the little mechanics may vary quite a bit, the overall stories that were being told are kind of weirdly similar in a way in these OSR blogs, and I think that's also fascinating. But I guess my point being, it's a lot of different ways of arriving at the same destination, I think.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I wrote down. You mentioned Varn is the game known for having a lot of tables. I wrote down the joy of tables as I was going through. I think it was the third issue. What is it about just a nice full page table that's so enjoyable?
I don't know. They just look kind of cool, don't they?
It's just so nice.
Carry me this far. I like a big table.
Yeah, there's just something you get a nice, you know, especially the ones like you have where they're sort of like multi-column, and you're like, okay, so you roll this bit, and then you can roll again, and it's this bit, and you roll again, and it's just like, I'm getting a lot of. I'm looking at this one page. I'm getting a lot of dice going. Something about that just feels good. Something about just feel you're doing something right.
Yeah. Well, I think. I have various thoughts on this, but one of them I think is that it's one of the things that these games can like. It's the format of like, I want to say storytelling, but it isn't storytelling. But it's something adjacent to that I don't quite have a word for. It's a method of fiction and information generation that, as far as I can see, only these games have, and that is the dice table that in its totality tells you something, but then also when you consult it with the dice, you get specifics that tell you something specific. Right. And I think that's really interesting because I touched on this before, but like the totality of all of the options on the table in Varn is always telling you stuff about Varn. And if you read, you know, if you read all the entries for, you know, I don't know the max, but I'm trying to think. Like the holy place is a good one, where the existence of the holy place itself tells you, okay, well, there's lots of weird religions in Varn, and there's lots of like, it's quite common to come across these holy places. And then when you read about the kind of relics that are the full list of the relics that could be worshipped there, you're like, okay, so these people kind of see the divine as potentially being inside almost anything. Like there can be beehives, or there can be an exploded bomb, and like in one sense, obviously it's just the randomizer of like, lol, here's a bunch of weird stuff. But I think for me, what makes it work is that for me, there actually was like a point behind it, which was what I just said to you, like for people in Varn, the divine and like the, you know, the numinous can be found in like all kinds of weird objects, and they don't just worship, you know, crucifixes or, you know, kind of things like that. And likewise with the kind of holy place attendants can be stuff like, you know, a sentient wasp hive, or there can be a robot or things like that. And you know, the fact that like robots can like sincerely and passionately believe in religion is something that's like quite an important touchstone in Varn, and it comes up quite a bit because I think it's very interesting. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, we've made an AI that's like intelligent enough to like truly be self-aware, and then ineroxably they all become religious too. Like, what does that say? That's a theory of consciousness there, right? That's like, you know, it's not just done to be weird. It's like it's kind of me saying that I think part of being fully self-aware and like conscious is grappling with those kind of feelings and questions that we don't really have answers for. And I strongly suspect that like sentient machines would actually arrive at the same like behavior patterns that we do, just in a different way. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I'm sure people disagree with me, but that's a thesis that's being presented there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's the interesting thing about Varn is everything feels fantastical, but in a way that feels, I think I've said this specifically, it feels grounded, it feels consistent with itself. And so while they're, you know, while your party might be like a mushroom guy and a big insect guy and a regular human and then a hyena lady,
yeah,
you know, it's they're all consistent with each other, they're all cohesive, they all seem to fit in this weird knot space. And it's interesting, yeah, to see how that works.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think, for some people it is too weird, and I'm keenly aware of the reputation that it maybe has for like being a lot of wacky random stuff, and obviously that is part of the fun, and it's a way of like sometimes kind of making jokes and like making these kind of absurd scenes as well, but. As I just said with the, you know, the robot religion or like things like that, there is there are kind of questions and like there's a kind of a point to some of it that is perhaps not always totally apparent, but I will say when people say they think it works and it feels like more than just a collection of completely weird, completely disconnected stuff, I think that's probably why is that I'm trying to say something with the totality of it all, even if it's not like outright said.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So if this is your first time here, homework is the little bit of the show where I ask the guests to bring a handful of things that they think are really cool and exciting, what they've been enjoying recently, to share with you in the same way that the podcast is me getting them to share their stuff with you. So Leo, go ahead. What do you have for us for homework?
Yeah, cool. I think another thing that I definitely could go on actually, but like something that drives... Another thing that kind of drives my fantasy writing is, and this may seem contradictory to what I said about me not caring about like the quote unquote reality of a place, but bear with me. Is I do enormous amounts of historical and like scientific reading, simply for the reason that like it's interesting and. The world is actually really, really strange, and there are people and things out there that I could never imagine, and my writing wouldn't be as rich without it. So on that note, the thing I've been reading recently, I have a really young son, so I don't get to read and do stuff as much as I'd liked, as much as I used to. But I've been reading The Anarchy by William Dalrymple. It's a work of narrative history, and it concerns the kind of dissolution of the Mughal Empire, specifically at the hands of the East India Company, which hailed from my country, obviously. And it is, man oh man, is this book fantastic. I'm about halfway through. It is just this, like, you know, if you like kind of Game of Thrones, you like kind of feudal epics and betrayals and huge battles, the collapse of this empire in India and like and you know in Bangladesh, and the kind of the collapse that's being aided by these interfering kind of foreign capitalists with access to like, you know, complete weaponry that completely outclasses anything that the empire has, is just absolutely fascinating. It reads like fantasy and science fiction mixed together. You know, huge personalities, crazy betrayals and battles, the devouring of this like corpse of this like ancient kind of feudal empire by this kind of rapacious like boa constrictor like, you know, nascent capitalist like entity basically that's just swallowing it all whole is loathsome and completely fascinating. Definitely like if you're into I guess if you're into learning about anything, the book's great. Like, it's really deeply researched. It uses a bunch of sources from the time period that haven't been translated before, so it is genuinely new material. But crucially, he also writes like a novelist, and you're just like on the edge of your seat, being like, "What's going to happen next?" Even though you know like what happens, but mm-hmm. That really real great gift for character and like drawing kind of human portraits of these people involved in this world. So that book is fantastic. It's been really well deservedly praised, so I'm not the only person to have found it. So that's what we're reading at the minute. On a totally different note, I have been really enjoying the comics of Simon Hanselman recently, specifically the ones on his Instagram. If you're not familiar with Hanselman, he does this comic called Magmog and Owl, which is about a witch and her cat and an owl who smoke weed and live together in some kind of house in suburban America, I guess. And he is just, I think, one of the funniest writers working today. It's just kind of like his comics just kind of capture that absolutely bleak, like stay at home stoner lifestyle in a way that I don't think I've seen anybody else ever manage to write about. And he's also just incredibly acidically like funny and weird. And the latest story that I've just been absolutely howling with laughter every single day has been the character Owl, who's this kind of if you watch Peep Show, he's basically Mark from Peep Show, but he's an owl. But he has to go off to break up with his new girlfriend, who's is a clown and is doing this like clown OnlyFans with other clowns and like making him film it. And he's not happy about this, so he has to go to the circus to break up with her. And it is just, I've just been crying laughing like at some of the strips, like waking up reading them. So that I definitely check out his work if you haven't already. He's pretty well known in like kind of indie comics, I think, but I don't know, it may be news to some people. So that's been very funny.
There's not a lot of time you get to say the phrase clown only fans, so.
Oh my god, you get to see it as well. I will say his comics are not safe for work. Do not read them if anybody else is around to be like, what are you reading? They're as rude as you can possibly get. So yeah, don't read them with anybody else around.
They're not, it's not even not safe for work. It's not safe for other people to see you read it.
No, it's not safe for like your friends to see you read it unless you're absolutely certain they have the same sense of humor as you. All right. Is this being videoed? I have one of his books actually. So this is the first one. This is from like 2014, but this is a good place to start, Mega Hex, if you do want to get into stuff. It's a really, really funny. Anyway, that's my handsome unplug. That stuff's real good. I think that's it actually, because as I said, I really don't have a lot of time to read things at the moment or even watch TV really. I guess I've been watching Agatha all along, but I don't know if I can recommend that to people. It's just kind of it's about all I can handle.
I hear that a lot from people who have recently had kids, and by recently, I think when you have a kid recently goes for about 4 years, where you
he's a toddler phase. Yeah,
yeah. As I say, as like you know, my partner's best friend had a child, and he's about to hit five. And it feels like they're just getting out back into the like we can do things socially and like it's interesting. It's definitely a struggle, and I think people who don't have kids don't understand in a fully way. And I don't have kids, I know I don't. I just hear it secondhand.
They do not realize how little time you actually have for a bit. Which is, you know, I signed up for it, obviously. It's great. It's awesome. On the flip side, I get to read books with him, which is incredible. Mm-hmm. Like, it's so much fun. But I can't really in good conscience recommend many picture books to the listeners. So
do you hear there's a new golden book? If you go down, there's like a line of Scooby-Doo golden books you might be really into.
Yeah, you guys had a Miffy. You can check out Miffy.
Hey, listen, I'll recommend Miffy. I like Miffy.
Great stories. Miffy is cool, actually. I like there's a Miffy show from 2015, which is actually pretty good. It's called Mephi Adventures Big and Small, and my son loves it. I watch it with him most days at the moment.
See, there you go. Listen,
it's a lot of fun.
Recommending children's media is, I think, way harder. Because I think you can recommend a book, yeah. You're like, oh, I'm just recommending the book that I'm reading, whatever. But recommending like children's media specifically has to be incredibly difficult.
It's weird. I mean, I'm exposed to a lot of it now. I really like animation, so I'm just trying to like get him to like shows that at least are quite well animated. And weirdly, the 2015 Mephi show, I actually think is really well animated, because if you're familiar with the Mephi books, they're very minimalist and kind of like brightly colored. And they managed to do that, like, but 3D, but like not make it look bad. It actually looks quite good. Which is really, really hard to do. I think most studios, given that brief, would have like completely fucked it. But whoever's behind that show, it looks great, honestly. Okay, so this is my third bit of homework. It's a completely bizarre recommendation, but if you have young children, Mephi Adventures Big and Small. Actually, it's really fun. It's quite sweet, and I think it's well animated in a way that is quite different to most shows. So I say take a gander at that, maybe.
No, I'm curious if my godson will like it. We'll have to try to get him to watch an episode or two.
It's quite fun.
Yeah,
it's quite well written too, which is weird to say. But
so I always love homework, because sometimes you get like the Mivy recommendation where it's just like, oh wow, I wouldn't have expected that at all. You know, sometimes you get a little surprise. It's a treat.
I didn't think I was gonna, and then I thought, like, actually, do you know what? We're talking about the whole breadth of human experience, so yeah. Why not? I've watched ungodly amounts of Mephi in the last month, so why not talk about it?
but that brings us to the final question. This is the three question. On the first episode, I asked my guest, the Amazing Star, who the top three people she would want to have on her podcast was, and ever since then. Ooh. Ever since then, I've asked the guests some variant of top three, whatever, as just a little nice little kind of button way to end the show. I don't come up with it ahead of time. I come up with it during the show so that it's a surprise even to me. Good top three question.
Oh, okay.
Try to not spend too long on these, because sometimes clever is the enemy of good.
I agree. Just go with your heart.
Yeah.
On this one.
Oh, here we go. Leo, what are your top three items to find buried at the bottom of the mysterious castle?
Oh, top three items. Well, you know that I'm hoping for some kind of light source. Preferably a kind of a supernatural gem of some kind that will cast a radiance, or you know, like a miner's helmet. And then obviously, people are thinking, oh, he's gonna say he wants a sword.
Classic.
No, my friends, you know, no. Violence is not, it's not the answer. The sword can easily be used to kill you as well. What I want is obviously, a ball of string, so I can tie it to something nearby, and then kind of like you can know which way you've gone. That's really important if I'm lost below the castle. Classic Theseus's kind of labyrinth shit. You know, it's the real heads know that like it's no point taking a sword if you're gonna starve to death because you got lost.
And, do you need a sword?
Finally. I would just really hope that there was like a bag of nuts or something, you know, kind of really compact, like energy source, again, so that while I'm wandering around with the magic gem and the probe, I'm not going to starve. I'm going to ration those nuts, and I'm really, really hope nobody hears me eating them.
These are the really funny ways that the real world can influence your game. If you let it happen, because it's so funny to have your players like in the store, you know, like at the store, like getting ready beforehand, like, okay, we got to make sure we have string and we have lanterns and stuff, and have someone just be like, does he have just like a bag of nuts? And it's just like, like three airplane thing of nuts, you know, just little foil bags of nuts. Yeah, sure. Why not?
Yeah, I want to find some trail mix. And, you know, they'll just keep me right. yeah, those are my things, I think.
That's good. I love the little bit, like, yeah, a sword can kill you just as easy. Like, you know, that's, yeah, you got to think about these things.
Honestly, yeah, like I unlike you, I think I live in a place where we're not allowed to have guns. but like the thing I'm always told is like, unless you know what you're doing, if someone breaks in your house, don't go and threaten them with a knife, because a lot of stabbings, actually, you know, it's the person who brought the knife to the fight who gets stabbed because they don't really know how to use it. You know, little, just dropping a little bit of wisdom for everybody here.
The thing I always say is I'd never own a gun because with my history, statistically, I'd be more likely to use it on myself. So,
yeah, exactly. You know, you just it's true. And likewise, it's why I don't have any knives, because I might stab myself with one. This has gone into another weird tangent, but
that's how it goes. Anyway, it's just the podcast energy.
I believe with all my heart that whatever energy you put out under the Dark Castle is what you will receive back. So I'm choosing the path of no violence.
You know, you won't bring violence into the space in the hopes that no violence will be brought absolutely to you.
No, I mean, the Minotaur lives there. I'm just like, you know, if you think about it, I'm the monster. I'm the one who's intruding.
Yeah, so, you just want to see what's going on. Like,
I'm going to, if he finds me, I'll just pretend that I don't. I'll pretend that, what would I do if he found me? Probably try and run away.
Share your nuts.
Obviously the, yeah, that's it, right? Well, you're like, I'm the nuts, I'll be like, yeah, hoping that he has an allergy and his throat closes up instantly and he dies.
Not bringing violence, you know, but secretly hoping that the Minotaur has a nut allergy.
Yeah, I mean, if he, you know, he is a monster.
Let me roll. Let me roll the table for nut allergy. Hang on one second. Let me.
Oh yeah. Oh, this is what I'm missing. Actually, that the simulationism is like, does the NPC have allergies? Like, do you have any allergens with you? Mm-hmm. Like, can you make them go into anaphylactic shock?
Yeah. Is he being exposed to any right now? Would you know?
Yeah. My argument here is, I figure, you know, you're more likely to develop allergies if you're not like exposed to the allergen, and I'm pretty sure the Minotaur isn't coming into contact with peanuts very often. You know, he lives in the labyrinth. As I understand it, his diet is mostly Theban, you know, men and women, so
probably not a lot of nuts. It doesn't sound like it.
No, I wouldn't assume so.
That's a great place to leave the podcast. Sometimes you gotta know when to say that's that's the best place to start.
Yeah,
right,
we're not going a better ending.
No, we're not doing better than that. Leo, please, before we go, let people know where they can find you, where they can keep up with Vaults of Varn.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Matt. Yeah, very simple. If you type in vaultsofvarn.com, that will take you to my website, where you can read all kinds of stuff about Vaults of Varn. I did deliberately choose the name so it would be easy to Google as well, so it should be fairly. I'm also, I feel like talking about social media at the moment, it just feels like describing where you are currently on a boat in the ocean that's going to move, because I have no idea like how long this episode's going to stay up or whatever. But at the time of writing, at the time that I'm recording this, I'm mostly on Blue Sky. My tag is infra beige, as in the beige beyond the visible spectrum, obviously. That's such a stupid name. That's me. I'm there. You can find me there if you'd like to read my posts. Please read my posts. That's me.
That's such the realest social media thing. Like, it's there if you want to read it. Please read it. Yeah. I'm sorry, my handle's dumb.
I'm pretending not to care, but I do care. I'd like, I want more followers.
That's real. Yeah. No, I can respect that. But yeah, I'd say go check out the Vaults of Varn backer kit like I usually do. But by the time you hear this, it's almost certainly done, and he smashed the hell out of it. Will there be pre-orders or anything up after the fact?
Happily, it has been an insane success, so I don't actually have to beg people to follow it. I'll just say if Varn is interesting to you, or if you read the website and think it sounds interesting, the book's going to be really good. And yeah, the backer kit is just going to be transitioning to being a pre-order store which is it basically just the campaign is going to continue, but it won't say that it's the campaign, which is funny, but whatever. So yeah, that's just going to be up until I have to start locking addresses, which is going to be like a year from now. So
yeah, perfect.
Yeah, that's please follow. Please yeah. Go and
yeah, so you can
pre-order a book if you would like one.
You just go get a book. Boom, done. No stress. Yep. I actually really like that about BaggerKit, where it's just like, okay, you've made all the money. People can still keep going. People can come along.
As soon as I read that about that feature, I was like, that's so obvious. I don't understand why it wasn't the standard before. But like, I obviously at some point I will have to like, you know, lock it in. But that point is not actually at the end of the campaign. So yeah, please, if you listen to this, you think you like the book, please, yeah. Please pre-order. It really helps me out because like the more pre-orders I have, like the bigger an order I can do, the cheaper it is like per unit, which is really useful. Mm-hmm. And just it helps a lot. So please, yeah.
Yeah, and if you pre-order, you're almost guaranteed to get one. So almost
guaranteed. Yeah, I can't 100% guarantee.
Right. Always the asterisk, always a chance. But
there's always a chance. Yeah, that you know the ship might get lost or something, but probably definitely you'll get one, yes.
But yeah, that'll be it. Leo, thank you so much for joining me. I appreciate you coming on and spending time. But that'll be it from
thank
us.
You, Matt.
Say bye, everybody.
Bye.
That's the podcast. I want to thank Leo so much for taking time to chat about Vaults of Varn. If this got you interested, the BaggerKit pre-order store is still currently live. You can go and pre-order your physical, digital, whatever you would like. There's even art prints I saw. All of that is still available to pre-order. And as always, the BaggerKit link will be in the description. The links to Leo's website and itch page will be in the description as well if you want to go see what else he's got going on and keep up with his work. While you're down there, you can find links to my social accounts and the show's social accounts, so you can follow us in various places to keep up with what's going on. I'm still working to catch up on the interviews I already have recorded, and that might go through all of October, because October is going to be very busy due to stream stuff. I don't talk about my stream on here. I don't talk about my stream very much explicitly, but right now, for the month of October, is Scaretober, where I do a lot of horror games and scary games. This Scaretober is different. I'm branching out from just playing horror video games to playing different tabletop stuff as well. Last night, as I'm recording this, my partner and I played Curios from Good Luck Press on stream. We'll be doing that a couple more times in the month of October. And coming up, I'm planning to play Thousand Year Vampire, hopefully once or twice, and get in one or two games of Arkham Horror, the card game. I'm even kicking around the idea of watching some analog horror videos or doing some deep dives into those weird fake horror YouTube like commercial things, you know, like the fake horror park ranger things. Just a fun way to explore more avenues of horror, more mediums for it than just here's a scary video game with a ghost. If that sounds interesting to you, you can check out the stream at twitch.tv/Matt Calder. I'm live weekday mornings Eastern time. If you can't make it live, VODs on Twitch last for, I believe, about 2 weeks. And I'm trying to get the VODs for Scaretober up on YouTube in a quicker fashion to just sort of get that stuff up on YouTube a little bit quicker than I normally have been. And as always, I have to thank our friends over at Plus One EXP. I know they're working on some really exciting things very soon. So I'm going to take this opportunity to remind you about our discount code. You can use code WDPODCAST to get 10% off anything in the store, physical or digital, or 10% off your first month of Zine Club, which I will heartily always recommend. Physical or digital, you can get some hot, fresh, exclusive games delivered right to your mailbox or your inbox. Now, as always, thank you so much for listening. This podcast has done so much more than I would have guessed a year ago when I started sort of putting the first pieces of this together. I've been so lucky to have such amazing people on the show and some incredible people express interest and, you know, send me good words. And I've thought a lot about what the point of this podcast is. And I've said it a couple times on the show, but I really just want to be a place for people to be able to talk about the thing that they're working on and be excited about it in a way that's kind of explicitly meant for air quotes marketing and for people to just be able to talk candidly about their work and their projects in a way that microblog, social media websites, or weird paywalled subscription newsletters kind of don't allow for. I definitely understand maybe I haven't done the best job with this podcast as I could have, but I feel like I learn something new every episode. Every new interview teaches me something about the form, about the structure. I'm doing research in my off time to try to polish up my skills on that. So hopefully you're enjoying yourself. Hopefully you're having a good time. And again, thank you so much for listening. Hope wherever you are, you're happy, you're healthy, and you're safe. And I'll see you in the next one.